the priests were no longer intent upon their service at the altar. Despising the sanctuary and neglecting the sacrifices, they hastened to take part in the unlawful proceedings in the wrestling arena after the call to the discus, disdaining the honors prized by their fathers and putting the highest value upon Greek forms of prestige. Welcome to 15 Minute Maccabees Episode 2, All Greek to Thee, The Challenge of Hellenism. I'm Mayor Soloveitchik. The time has come to talk about athletics and its relationship with religion. Once in a while, we encounter an athlete in whom faith is fused with physical prowess. Some New Yorkers will remember what was termed by the tabloids Linsanity during the successful period with the New York Knicks of the religiously devout Jeremy Lin. Then there was Tim Tebow, whose exploits on the football field were followed by what was known as Tebowing, kneeling in reverent prayer after a game. But perhaps the most interesting artistic depiction of religious athleticism can be found in the movie Chariots of Fire, featuring the story of the Jewish runner Harold Abrams and the Christian athlete Eric Little competing in the 1924 Paris Olympics, whose 100th anniversary will be marked in the Paris Games next year. Chariots is one of my favorite films, yet the more I watch it, the more I have come to understand the terrible Jewish irony that lies at its heart. As I noted in commentary, in the film, Harold Abrams responds to anti-Semitism not with Jewish pride but with assimilation. We see him in the movie ebulliently belting out HMS Pinafore as his aspiration. In spite of all temptations to belong to other nations, he remains an Englishman. He remains an Englishman. When Abrams is confronted at Cambridge by anti-Semitic dons who accuse him of only having interest in his own glory, Abrams says nothing about his ancient heritage and instead indignantly insists, "I am a Cambridge man first and last. I am an Englishman first and last. What I have achieved and what I intend to achieve is for my family, for my university, for my country." Particularistic Jewishness in the film was anathema to Abrams. All this accords with who Abrams originally was. In an interesting doctoral dissertation titled Jews and British Sport, David Garrity notes that, quote, "Abrams claimed the most important factor in Jewish sporting success was a willingness to anglicize and to move away from one's religion," end quote. D notes that in the 1920s, the decade in which the film is set, Abrams wrote an article in an Anglo-Jewish publication encouraging English Jews to ignore Jewish Sabbath restrictions in order to compete on Saturdays. It's hard not to note the contrast between Eric Little, who, as depicted in the film, refused to run on the Christian Sabbath, and Abrams, who urged Jews to run on the Jewish Sabbath. In his article, Abrams argued that religion, quote, "has little, if anything, to do with the qualities which characterize an athlete," end quote. In contrast, for Eric Little, as depicted in the film, religion had everything to do with his qualities as an athlete. He informs his sister in one of the central moments of the movie, "I believe God made me for a purpose." And then he adds, "but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure." After a committee of English aristocrats seeks unsuccessfully in the film to pressure Little to run on Sunday, one of them sagaciously reflects that Little, quote, "is a true man of principle and a true athlete. His speed is a mere extension of his life, its force. We sought to sever his running from his self," end quote. It's with this in mind that we can return to the Hanukkah story. For rightly understood, the question of the essence of athletics, of physical feats, lies at the heart of this tale. Indeed, it was the gymnasium, a center of athletic celebration, that was originally the main medium of acculturation and assimilation, of entry into a Hellenistic way of life, of shedding the Judaic and adopting the Greek identity. That is why only when we understand the origins of Jewish assimilation in the age of the Maccabees, as well as the Hellenistic persecution that followed, can we better comprehend why the military prowess of the Maccabees comprised a genuine religious response to all that Athens embodied. It was in the year 175 BCE that the Seleucid Emperor Seleucus IV died. Though he had a son who was ostensibly his heir, power was seized by the younger brother of Seleucus IV, Antiochus IV, known as Antiochus Epiphanes, meaning Antiochus the Magnificent. Antiochus was an apostle of Athenian culture. Though not of the city, it was he who had begun building the Temple of Olympian Zeus in Athens, which ultimately became the largest pagan temple in the known world. But equally important for Antiochus's political vision was the fact that he had been held hostage as a young man in Rome and had experienced the way Rome expanded its influence by offering citizenship to non-Romans willing to embrace the Roman way of life, to those that were willing to do as the Romans did. Antiochus chose to advance a Greek version of this, offering citizenship in his capital, Antioch, to all those that were willing to undergo the training and acculturation required, to all those embracing an Athenian, or at least a Hellenistic, identity. It was with this proposal that the eager embrace of Hellenism by some of Jerusalem's Jews began. One elite Jewish Jerusalemite by the name of Jason of the Onaiad family, the younger brother of the high priest Onias, or Chonio, sought to have the high priesthood given instead to him, in return for the advancement of Antiochus's citizenship plan. Thus we are told by the second book of Maccabees, quote, "When Seleucus died and Antiochus, who was called Epiphanes, succeeded to the kingdom, Jason, the brother of Onias, obtained the high priesthood by corruption, promising the king at an interview 360 talents of silver and, from another source of revenue, 80 talents. In addition to this, he promised to pay 150 more if permission were given to establish by his authority a gymnasium and a body of youth for it, and to enroll the men of Jerusalem as citizens of Antioch. When the king assented and Jason came to office, he at once shifted his countrymen over to the Greek way of life." End quote. Note the emphasis on physical training. A gymnasium, we are told, was created by Jason with youth that would enroll in it. In his commentary on the Book of Maccabees, to which this podcast is indebted, Jonathan Goldstein explains that the gymnasium was the site of what was known as the ephebic organization, which was the essential form of civic education that involved the embrace of the training of citizens dedicated to Hellenism. And for Jerusalem, it would be the source of assimilation of Judeans into Hellenistic identity. Goldstein writes, quote, "Jason the Onaiad here wishes to bring the Jews of Jerusalem, under his own leadership, into Antiochus' scheme for an Antiochian Republic in imitation of the Roman Republic. As Antiochians, citizens of the Republic, they would gain great privileges and would associate with other privileged citizens from all over the Seleucid Empire. Though Antiochus imitated Rome, the institutions, language, and culture of his Republic were to be Greek. Jason must have been very wealthy. He was ready to pay the vast sum of 150 talents for the privileges and power which would go to the founder of the citizen community. He would draw up the original list of adult citizens and would found the gymnasium and ephebic organization, the educational system through which privileged adolescents would enter the ranks of citizens," end quote. This, of course, would mean that those who took part in the gymnasium would be weaned off the particularistically Jewish ways of life. It was therefore all the more outrageous to traditional Jews that Jason chose to create the gymnasium at the center of Jerusalem, near the temple itself. This is stated in the Book of Maccabees again, quote, "He destroyed the lawful ways of living and introduced new customs contrary to the law. For with alacrity he founded a gymnasium right under the citadel, and he induced the noblest of the young men to wear the Greek hat," end quote. Here again we must understand the role that athletics played in Hellenistic society. The gymnasium utilized the Ephebian system involving males that had passed puberty. As Goldstein explains, the education and acculturation of these young men took place in the gymnasium. And in Greek society, athletics was performed in the nude with nothing but a hat with a broad brim to shade them in the sun. While Goldstein questions whether all of the Jews themselves exercised in the nude, whether they all fully embraced Greek ways in totality, it is essential to emphasize, as Goldstein further notes, that this location for ephebic training was more than a place for physical feats. The space dedicated to athletic aspects of the experience lay at the center, but built around it were classrooms for further Greek education and acculturation. While Jason can be considered what Goldstein calls a moderate Hellenizer, it can, I think, still be said, as the Book of Maccabees emphasizes, that through Jason the paganization of Jerusalem began, at least in terms of culture. After all, the elite of Jerusalem were the temple priests, and it was they that were most attracted to the gymnasium thereby. The Book of Maccabees again. "There was such an extreme of Hellenization and increase in the adoption of foreign ways because of the surpassing wickedness of Jason, who was ungodly and no high priest, that the priests were no longer intent upon their service at the altar. Despising the sanctuary and neglecting the sacrifices, they hastened to take part in the unlawful proceedings in the wrestling arena after the call to the discus, disdaining the honors prized by their fathers and putting the highest value upon Greek forms of prestige," end quote. Thus, through the attractions of Greek athleticism, the dedication to the faith of our fathers dramatically decreased in the sacred city. And when Antiochus Epiphanes passed through Jerusalem, he received a glorious greeting from the city's elite and fully began to think of the capital of Judea as another Hellenistic city in his empire. With Antiochus' perspective in mind, we can truly appreciate what next occurred. And here again, I draw on the timeline given us by Goldstein. Jason proved insufficiently Hellenistic for some Hellenistic Jews, and in 172, another Jew by the name of Menelaus convinced Antiochus to install him instead as the high priest. The paganization of Jerusalem thus continued apace. In 170 BCE, when Antiochus waged war with Egypt, Menelaus utilized the vessels of the temple as part of the tribute that was owed to Antioch, a gift that was decried and protested by the Jews of Jerusalem that remained loyal to the old faith, a protest that was to no avail. In mid-169 BCE, it was rumored that Antiochus had died in battle against the Ptolemies in Egypt, and Jason mustered forces to enter Jerusalem and overthrow Menelaus to restore him to the high priest position. Meanwhile, the traditional Jews of Jerusalem fought against both of these unworthy high priests, against both Jason and Menelaus, seeking to retain a Judaic Jerusalem. Antiochus turned out to be very much alive, having been enormously successful in his military campaign against the Ptolemies in Egypt, though he was forced to pull back because of the pressure of Rome. Antiochus then sent his general Apollonius to take away the high priesthood from Jason and to reinstall Menelaus. The forces of Apollonius were permanently installed in a fortress near the temple. Laws enforced by these troops were put in place, making the pagan lifestyle mandatory, banning the most elemental aspects of Judaism and forcing assimilation into Hellenism. The first book of Maccabees succinctly summarizes the decrees. Quote, "Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that each should give up his customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die." End quote. The paganization of the temple in Jerusalem was thus complete, and we are informed of the precise date in which this occurred, the 25th day of the Jewish month of Kislev, in the year 167 by Goldstein's count. We can thus draw a line from the creation in around 174 BCE of a gymnasium with its glorification of physicality to the desecration of the temple altar in 167. It all began with athletics. I sometimes say to my students or quip to my congregants that the lesson of the Hanukkah story is that the true enemy of Abrahamic faith is exercise, and that this explains why on Hanukkah we celebrate by eating as much fried food as possible. But this, of course, is a joke. Some of the most astonishing physical feats combined with courage will be performed by the Maccabees. We will see them assault elephants, taking on what must have been the most terrifying form of cavalry that can be conceived. Indeed, it can be said that in the Maccabees will be found martial magnificence largely unknown among Judea's Jews since the fall of the first temple. What was said in Chariots of Fire about little can truly be said in a Jewish way about the Maccabees, that they were true men of principle and true athletes. Their speed was a mere extension of their life, its force. The Maccabees represent physicality fueled by faith and by the moral worldview that the Torah proclaims. It is their revolt that we will describe in the next episode, but it is important to stress how their physicality was in its own way a response to Greek physicality. I visited London in the summer of 2012, right after the Olympics, in that city. Olympic fever still was everywhere, and a stage version of Chariots of Fire was ongoing. But what was occurring in London then was, to my mind, much more inspiring than the Olympics, the Paralympics. It is striking that even as Plato's Republic argued for the infanticide of those born with disabilities, the Paralympics embody the celebration of the preciousness of all human beings, a value that was bequeathed by Jerusalem, not Athens. And this brought to my mind a story that had occurred a bit earlier in 2012, when a female Israeli Paralympic rower by the name of Moran Samuel was competing in a pre-Paralympic rowing competition in Italy. She won, expecting to hear the national anthem of Israel, but no recording of Hatikva had been prepared, and so she took the mic and sang it herself with the Hatikva, the hope, coming from within. A gifted basketball player who had been struck from the waist down by a stroke in her spine at the age of 24, she took up rowing, which focused on upper body strength, and she told Israeli TV that after her stroke had occurred, people expected her to be overcome by depression. But, she said, "I wasn't a person like that before, and I couldn't be like that during." In explaining how she made it through, she described, "Ha'optimiut kozesh u'kavua bagenim, my optimism which is encoded in my genes." Such a person found hatikva, the hope. To study the story of the Maccabees is to learn of the combination of moral courage and physical excellence that they displayed, but both were extensions of a life force, of the hope, of the faith they found within. In this family, in a dark time, it was this hope that was about to be kindled. This is Meir Soloveitchik wishing you a joyous and meaningful Hanukkah, signing off.